Attention, attention all personnel. It's MASHcast.
Hello and welcome to MASHcast, the show that analyzes and celebrates, episode by episode, the greatest TV series of all time, MASH, which aired on CBS from 1972 to 1983. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, General Robert Iron Guts Kelly. And joining us this week in the VIP tent is returning special guest star, Major Amanda Reyes. Hi, Amanda.
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing great. I'm happy to have you back for season three.
I'm super happy to be here. Wow, three seasons. How many episodes have you guys covered then? A bunch, right?
I think this is number 57 so far, so I only have another 200 to go.
Wow. Well, you know, that's funny because, you know, I do a podcast, a solo cast called The Trap Cast, which is about Trapper John M.D.
Yes.
And I started it last year and I'm on episode four. So.
How many years did that show run? Like seven or eight?
So I think it was six.
Six, okay.
Maybe seven. But yeah, definitely at least six. And there's at least 150 episodes.
So you'll be doing it for a long time.
I think so, yeah.
All right, okay. Well, of course, this episode features Trapper. It is from season three. It's episode, it's episode 57, episode nine of the season. Alcoholics Unanimous. The original air date was November 12th, 1974. Written by Everett Greenbaum and Jim Fritzell and directed by Hy Averback. While Henry is in Seoul giving a lecture, the U.S. Army's position on the hemorrhoid, things couldn't be more depressing at the 4077th. Rain is falling in buckets, the sound from the movie has gone out, and Frank is in charge. After Hawkeye and Trapper get back to the swamp in a surly mood, Frank gets the bright idea to ban all drinking from the 4077th total prohibition. Of course, no one takes too well to this news, driving Hawkeye and Trapper to even attend Father Mulcahy's morning service just to see if they can get a nip of the sacrificial wine. Frank turns to Hollibs for support, but he's troubled by the fact that she drinks too. From a flask, she calls her little nippy bottle. Frank, as always, makes an exception when it involves him and or Hollibs. Hawkeye and Trapper then decide to break into the camp's medicine supply to get some alcohol. When they hear a noise, they hide, but are surprised to see Hollibs is there for the same reason too. Cut to Hawkeye, Trapper, and Hollibs in the swamp, partying together, completely drunk. Frank tries to restore order, but he storms out when even Hollibs joins in on the teasing of their commanding officer. He then asks Father Mulcahy to give a real fire and brimstone lecture about the evils of drink and makes attendance mandatory. The next morning, Hawkeye and Trapper are hungover and surly, even squabbling with one another. Their fighting continues all the way into a session in OR and then into Father Mulcahy's service. But when Mulcahy, a little tipsy from taking a few shots from a flask to calm himself down over the idea of having so many people in the pews, forgets where he is, it turns the service into a shambles. Arguments break out, and the pressure finally gets to Frank, who starts drinking from Margaret's flask like a baby with a bottle. Hawkeye and Trapper realize that the era of prohibition at the 4077th is now over. All right, Amanda. So why do you love this episode?
You know, it's interesting. I'm thinking back to why did I pick this episode, because I don't really remember it that well, except it must have been Father Mulcahy, because he's a character that I love. Mm-hmm. And I must have been looking when you gave me the option to do season three, a chance to see him. And so the other episodes I covered, I don't remember him playing much of a part.
No.
And so this was a good chance. And he's really great in this. And there's a kind of seeing him at work. Right. With the church, right, with Klinger, which was really funny. And what's funny is, I guess we'll get into the meat and bones of everything, but, you know, when we first see him giving a service, there's a woman sitting in the pew, and I was pretty sure it was Klinger, but the angle that they shot it, and it lingered long enough that I actually started to think it was a real woman and it wasn't Klinger. And so when they cut to Klinger, I was like, oh, wait, okay. I thought it was just this Korean woman, you know, sitting there, and this was going to be some, like, really sweet moment. And then it's just this crazy – it's my favorite scene in the episode. But so I think it was a Father Mulcahy thing, and I also like the light tone of it. This is a really light episode. Like, I wouldn't say it's laugh out loud in a lot of places, but it's really fun. And just your synopsis shows how much they crammed into 30 minutes. There's a lot going on in this episode. So it's kind of a great paced episode too.
Yeah. I mean, it is one of their, it is a very funny episode, but it also, again, it deals with, it's kind of one of their issue episodes. I mean, it's an alcoholics episode. It's about, you know, the dangers of alcohol. And I think they treated it fairly well. You're right. They do cram a lot into this episode. I mean, when I was writing the synopsis, I'm like, wow, I'm already just on to the first act break, and they still have this whole other thing to do. I mean, in a lot of other shows, the dramatic turn where Hawkeye and Trapper get into the fight, which has a real edge to it. I really like that. I mean, we're jumping around, but I like that scene where they get into the fight where they start. They're obviously hungover and they're sniping at one another, and they're getting tired of kind of living with each other. And then the fight escalates to the point where Hawkeye grabs a guitar, and Trapper grabs a bedpan, and they're really about to bash each other's brains out. And then Wayne Rogers, Trapper himself, of course, has that great moment where he says, You don't think it's true, right? And Hawkeye's like, what? That we're alcoholics. And there's a real little bit of tension in there because you really feel like that if they had pushed it a little further, it would have gotten really out of hand.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting episode. And I also love, I have to say, I mean, I guess everybody loves to hate him, but Frank Burns is so great. And even though I was missing Blake in this, Colonel Blake, I love when he takes over, because when you think about it, nothing was really odd about that episode in terms of, like, there wasn't a lot of casualties that they had to deal with. It was pretty much a day-to-day, 9-to-5 job. There was a lot of pressure in their day-to-day life. But then he comes in, Burns, and he has to, like, just uproot everything and make everything so different and so unusual and so wrong. And, like, he could have just floated through that time that Blake was gone. But he can't – Burns doesn't have it in him to just let things happen.
Right.
He has to, like, change the rules. And, like, if it's not fixed – if it's not broken, don't fix it. But if it's not broken, he has to break it somehow.
Yep.
Right? And so, like, that's just how he goes through life. And so I love when he kind of gets a chance to just, like, exercise his power, because his power is always incorrect.
Right.
No matter what he chooses. And it's kind of fun to watch him. And I really like the actor. I like Larry Linville a lot. And
yes.
It's great to kind of see him in action. So it was kind of fun to see him take over and be king for a day and see what he did with it.
I always wondered, did Frank get in trouble with either Blake or Potter when they got back? And he, like, completely upended all the rules? Like, did the commanding officer say, you did what while I was gone? Like, I always wondered, did he get away with it? I guess you kind of have to, but I always thought, does Frank never suffer from doing any of this kind of stuff? Well, he's, like, drunk with power. It seems kind of great. No pun intended. It seems kind of crazy that he would do that. I mean, pull it on. And, of course, you know, as typical with Frank Burns, as I mentioned in the synopsis, when he finds out that Margaret is drinking, he says, oh, it's your nerve juice. Like, he always makes an exception for her. And that's something going on and on, you know, in throughout the series, is that when it's Margaret doing it, when it's him doing it, it's fine. When it's someone else does it. In fact, at one point, he literally says to Hawkeye and Trapper, when they talk about why they drink, he's like, I don't care about your personal problems. Well, that's the whole thing, isn't it, Frank? Is that the way people are drinking? Is because they have problems. And, like, that's not a thing a commander can say. I don't care about your personal problems. You're like, well, that's kind of part of your job, buddy. But, yeah, he is magnificent here. And I always – I you know, by this point, everyone knows that McLean Stevenson was very unhappy on the show. And there are whole episodes, and this is one of them, that he's not in at all. And I always wondered, was that McLean Stevenson who was like, I want off for the week, let me go do something else? Or was it the writers that were sort of seeing him eye the door and were like, well, what can we do? Can we do a show without, like, let's build that muscle and learn to do a show without him entirely? And it's interesting because I love McLean Stevenson as Blake, but I don't really miss him in this episode.
No, yeah, I thought I would at first because, like, oh no, he's gone. The thing about McLean Stevenson is that, like, if you ever watch Match Game, when he would come on as a guest, he's almost the same person. Like, he's not dopey, but there's this very calm demeanor to him. Like, it's really hard to rile up Blake, I think, in some way that means something. And when you watch him on Match Game, he has that same kind of delivery, and I really like it. It's funny, but it's very under the radar. And so I like watch. Yeah, that's right. I didn't even think of that. But it's like his delivery is just really kind of magical in the way he does it. But it feels like it's a lot of him coming through to me. And I enjoy it. And so when he's not there, you know, I miss it. But you're right. I think there was enough Burns, like, doing whatever Burns does to kind of keep your mind off the fact that he wasn't there.
Larry Linville must have loved getting those scripts, because it's like if McLean Stevenson's not in that week, he gets a lot more to do. You know, that's got to be just great for an actor. You're like, oh, you know, all of a sudden I get a ton more to do. And you mentioned Father Mulcahy, and the scene in the tent where you mentioned where we see the services. I mentioned this on previous episodes in that when I've watched these in syndication, sometimes the syndicator would snip out one entire scene or maybe one and a half scenes, or they would take out like 30 seconds out of individual scenes to get it down. This scene with Mulcahy and Klinger in the mess tent, which is a long scene. It's like a good 3 or 4 minutes is completely missing in the syndicated version. Oh. I never saw this scene until I got the DVDs. And that's a shame because Mulcahy to this point, of course, didn't get a lot to do and neither did Klinger. And this is like a really great moment for the two of them. Like it's just them until Hawkeye and Trapper show up. But it's like the syndicator decided, we don't need this. And they just lopped the entire scene right out.
Oh, that's horrible. Cause first of all, it's really important to the story. Cause we're supposed to know that Mulcahy never gets anybody to come to his services. And also I kind of like, so Klinger is obviously just a guy going in drag to try to get kicked out of the military, but I love the way that Mulcahy kind of accepts him too. And so like their dynamic is really good. And he's actually telling the guys when Trapper and Hawkeye show up, he's like, tell him you like his gloves. Yeah. He's got a thing about his gloves. So tell him you like him. And like, he's sensitive to this weird person that comes in drag every Sunday to listen to a service just to wear the nice white gloves. Right. And so,
it's one of my favorite jokes in the episode is the white glove bit.
Yes.
Where he's going on and on to telling them about where he gets it in a catalog. And he's you trace your hand and then you write it. And then without breaking stride, he's like, you really don't care, do you?
Yeah, Klinger got really into his drag bit. Like, I love that because he was, you know, the whole point was he wants to get kicked out of the military. But he really, like, when he talks about the fashion that he wears, he's serious about it, you know, and he gets impassioned by it. And so it makes it that much more funnier and it also adds to the character, I think. And so, yeah, so having that not in there, I think, would be just really sad to me. I'm trying to think of the word I want to use. But, a disappointment if I knew it was there and then didn't see it later.
Yeah, and it is sort of it is really kind of offensive for Hawkeye and Trapper to be like, we're going to show up so we can get a nip of your sacramental wine. Like, geez, guys, it's kind of a dick move. I mean, like, he's nice to them about it, but I thought, boy, that's kind of out there. But I mentioned this in the previous episode, Life with Father, where we learned that Mulcahy has a sister who's a nun, and it's really his first any sort of story arc where he gets something that goes from beginning of the episode to the end of the episode where we follow the story. And with this, he's starting to get more to do. And I think the writers were seeing, hey, William Christopher could really be funny, really pull off these moments. And you could see that he was on his way to becoming more than just an occasional guest star. They were really giving him more to do. And I also find it very touching, as you said, that him and Klinger are sort of close. I think that's very sweet, and that, like you said, that he's so accepting that he treats Klinger as a regular person. I mean, I'm sure he's happy that Klinger's there, and I also like that Klinger is religious. Like, that's a fun angle. I mean, he says that he does it just so he wears the clothes, but in other episodes when we did see Father Mulcahy services, they always put Klinger there. He's always there, and I thought that's a nice touch that Klinger is a religious person. That's a nice little detail to give this character.
Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't know he showed up in all the scenes that they would have like that. That's very consistent too, and that's nice just for the storylines, you know.
Yeah, I like that. I like that a lot. So then the after that scene, we get the bit with the nippy bottle in Margaret's tent, and Frank has another wonderfully racist line where he talks about that he could have ridden further up, except his congressman was a Lithuanian, and he says it with this horrible disdain, and it's just like, oh god, all right, Frank.
I know, it's so tough because he's horrible, but he's lovable in a weird way. And I think it's because I think because there's that line, I don't even remember what episode it's from, but where he says stuff like, it's nice to be nice to the nice.
Yes.
And there's something so wide-eyed about Burns and innocent. Even though he's an adulterer, he's a racist, he's an oppressor, right? And like all these things, but there's also this childlike quality that Larry Linville brings to the character that I love. And so like, I just like him. I can't help it. Like, I don't know if I would be that person's friend in real life. I would probably feel like Hawkeye most of the time. But to watch him in the mix of the show, he's so important to me because he's so much fun and because he is very dynamic.
And they give him silly stuff to do, and he pulls it off. I mean, it's that scene where he is modeling Margaret's bra.
I love that so
much. And he's got it around his shirt, and he actually comes out to sign something for Radar, and Radar is just pretending he's not seeing it, and Frank doesn't even get it. He doesn't even understand, even notice that he's still got the bra on.
Yeah, he's totally forgotten. And I love that the way Radar looks at the bra, it's obvious that it's because he's wearing a bra on the outside of his pant on his shirt, and he's a guy. But also, it's the way you see men leer at women. Mm-hmm. When they wear low cut stuff, it's almost like the same eyeing of the chest, and it's just really funny.
I even thought of that.
That made me laugh. It's a really cute moment. I love anything with Margaret and Frank, though. Like, they were doomed from the start, but they're just hilarious to me.
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah, they are a great pair. And this is, speaking of Margaret, this is a I've mentioned in previous episodes, and I got to tell this to Loretta Swit herself last year, is Loretta Swit does one of the great drunks in acting. That is hard to do. It's really hard to do drunk well, because I think most people exaggerate it or whatever. And after the scene where they confront her in the supply tent, where she's trying to get some liquor as well, the three of them are drunk in the swamp. And Loretta Swit just does such a marvelous drunk. And the three of them, where they're singing the song, and come on in, take off your skin, I'll rot around in your bones. It feels improvised. It probably isn't. From what I heard of MASH, it was never improvised. Larry Gelbart was pretty strict about that. But it feels it. It feels like three drunk people talking, and where, like, Trapper is laughing at everything that they're saying, but he's like a half beat behind. And it feels completely genuine.
Yeah, you know, that's funny that you said that. I didn't realize. I always assumed they did some improvising, because of the way Alan Alda bursts out in laughter. Mm. It feels so natural when he does that. There's that one episode, of course, I can't remember the full episode again, but the one where Frank Burns puts on his helmet and there's an egg in it.
Yes.
Hawkeye just starts laughing. And if every time I used to watch that with my parents just swore that that wasn't supposed to happen and that that was a completely natural reaction. And so when I was watching that drunk scene, I was actually thinking it must be improvised, at least some of it, because there was something so natural about it. And, like, especially like that when Frank Burns leaves and Loretta Swit says, "Who was that?" Yeah. And the way they just start laughing is just, it just feels so like she just must have said that without any knowledge that she was going to say it beforehand, but that just shows how good they are.
Yeah, the way she kind of mutters it a little, she doesn't lean on the joke, like she doesn't say, "Who was that?" She just kind of say it, you actually could miss it if you're not paying close attention, the way when he finally storms off, she's like, "Who was that?" He says it exactly like the way a drunk person would say it. And, of course, they have the run about where they got the liquor, and it's all about putting it in an enema bag, which makes me gag even to think about it. And they're doing the whole bit about you hang it under a tree for 16 weeks, days, 16 day, whatever it is. And, yeah, I mean, as far as I understood from what I've read, Larry Gelbart, they did not improvise. They followed the script. But, again, it shows what good actors they were, that they could make it seem improvised, because it always reads that way to me.
Yeah, me too. Wow.
Yeah. So they said that we have the act break, and, you know, Frank finally says that tears it. And there's even this great moment where he's chastising the three of them, and he's like, "Anyone is caught." And he goes, "Anyone." And he leans into Margaret, and she goes, "Whoop." I love her response to it. She's Loretta Swit just does such a great drunk. I mean, she's just fantastic at it. So that's the act break. And then they come back and we find out again, another bit for Mulcahy to do, where he has to give a temperance lecture. And there's this bit, and maybe you can explain it to me, Amanda, because I don't fully understand it. He starts talking about a training film that he saw on like a Navy ship. And he's talking about, a lovely girl who with a megaphone on her chest. And then they talk about that they lived with two other men and a woman with a whip. And that's right. And he's kind of just meandering, and Frank is, like, you know, not paying attention to him. And then he says, broker's wristwatch and everything.
Yeah.
I don't know. What is he talking? Is it like a – what is he talking about? I don't – it sounds like it's a porn film, but I doubt Mulcahy watched that.
I kind of feel like it was supposed to be an adult film too, and they were showing it under the guise of like a hygiene or sex film that they show, because they used to make those movies. And actually, I think Rue McClanahan was in one of them.
Oh my!
Yeah, I feel like I'd have to look that up, and I wish I had now. That they used to make these films that they would show, I think, people in the military about, like, so this is why you don't want to have sex with women in Korea that aren't part of the military or whatever, and so because this could happen, and they're like hygiene films or whatever. But I was under the impression that whoever showed the film slipped in a porno, okay, and then to show an adult film, but then did it under the guise of one of these quote unquote hygiene films.
Okay.
And,
all right.
And so he was watching, and I think he's meandering almost, I guess in retrospect, that there's sort of almost a trauma to it. Do you know what I mean? Because,
yeah, yeah.
But then he wishes he had a film, right? So he talks about, yeah, I'll go ahead and give this lecture, and he's leaving, and he's like, I wish I had a film.
Yeah.
And so because maybe it turned him off everything. Maybe that was the film. Maybe that was what he needed to see to know.
All right. Well, then I'm not crazy then, because when he gets to the point about the woman with a whip, I'm like, that doesn't sound like a training film. That sounds like a porn. So, all right, now it makes sense. All right, I always thought I was imagining it, but broke his wristwatch and everything. I was like, okay, all right. And then there's a scene in OR. We find out that Frank has closed the O Club, which is crazy because you don't have to close the O Club. You could just not serve alcohol. You could let people play their pinball and stuff and socialize. Like, again, Frank's a terrible commander. And then there's this brief scene in OR where they're sniping at one another. And then there's the scene in the swamp where Hawkeye and Trapper, again, it leads to the fight. And this features, again, some of my favorite lines where we see Trapper is shaving, Hawkeye is going through a pile of magazines, and he's sort of just carelessly throwing them all over the tent. And he's bored by the fact that mixed in with presumably his porno mags are Trapper's Popular Mechanics and Field and Stream. And I love when he reads an article and he says, how to wrap a grizzly bear for mailing, which is idea. And then later on in the episode, as a retort, he tells Trapper to go mail a bear, which I just love. That's an ongoing thing about that there would be an article in Field and Stream that you have to wrap a grizzly bear and send it to somebody.
Well, you never know.
You never know what you need. I guess so. You know, you might need that. I never fully got the sense that this was the next morning, that they're already, because I could see that they would be hung over the next morning because they really got drunk. But I always thought the reason they're so surly with each other is because they're going through the DTs. That's why they're mad. And I don't think you go through the DTs the next morning. I don't think it sets in that fast. But I guess they have to collapse the timing of the episode because, you know, it can't take place over too long a period of time.
Yeah, that was my impression too. I figured that they were just going through the withdrawal period, and that's what made them so kind of angsty with each other. But you're right, it is very quick. But I guess when you drink that much, I would imagine, like, going an hour with your body not having it probably starts to freak out a little.
Probably, yeah. I guess if you get that loaded. I haven't gotten that level drunk that many times in my life, but I don't remember being – I remember being miserable the next morning, but not necessarily surly, but maybe my friends could correct me on that assumption. So then, again, they go to the service, and we see that they're still surly with one another. And we talked earlier about how Klinger is Mulcahy's pal. Early on, when we see that Klinger is helping Mulcahy get through it, and he gives him a nip of some liquor, and he says, this will help you get through it. I love that he's helping Mulcahy get prepared, which is really cool. And then later on, during the service, when it becomes clear that Mulcahy is probably a little rambling, Hawkeye makes a joke, and you even have Klinger shush Hawkeye. Which is like, you never saw that. Because Klinger is a corporal. And even though the 477th is a pretty democratic place in terms of, not treating the officers any better than the enlisted, it's kind of gutsy for Klinger to do that. And I think that's in a small way, that's very touching, that he wants Father Mulcahy to succeed. And when Hawkeye is kind of like doing like an MST3K thing, he even says, he's like, shh. I like that. I like that little detail. I think that's a great little – I don't know, again, if that's in the script or, again, probably not an ad-lib, but I thought that was a nice little bit of character for Klinger.
Yeah, you know, the way you describe it, it actually made me think of, like, the equivalent would be, like, Richie confronting the Fonz on Happy Days.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you know, when he did that and you're like, whoa, what are you doing?
Yeah,
you
know? Yeah. you're bucking the chain of command here, kind of. So I really like that bit. And then this whole scene of Father Mulcahy drunk on the pulpit is really, I'd say, one of the show's best comedy runs, because the way William Christopher kind of pickles his voice a little bit, and he does this thing, and he's talking about Leviticus 10, and he repeats himself, and then he finally culminates. So I think it was Leviticus on the 10th, I believe. Yeah. He's just completely rambling, and it's a great – he just, again, I don't know if William Christopher does a great drunk necessarily, like as good as Loretta Swit, but it's a great run of just watching somebody try so hard to keep it together, and he can't between the drink and the nerves. He's really funny in this scene.
Yeah, he's always great. He's also, I guess he's like Blake in that he has a very under the radar, no pun intended again, delivery about him. Everything about William Christopher is kind of quiet.
Yes.
And so sometimes even when he's being really funny, you're kind of like, is he being really funny? Because he's so quietly funny. And so when he's doing this, it's like a standout, you know, really shows how good he is at comedy. Because I think sometimes when we think about MASH, I don't know that we always think about Father Mulcahy as being the funny guy, you know. And here we get a chance to really see that he can be, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I would imagine as an actor, and you're one of the side characters like this, you're not a regular. You're waiting for these moments, you know, you can get something and really sink your teeth into it and show the producers, hey, I can do this. If you give me the ball, I'm going to score. And he does here. He really does. He's very, very funny. And I also like where I've mentioned again on other episodes that, you know, TV is not a director's medium. It's a writer's medium. And they're, especially for a show like MASH, where the sets are so drab and it's all the same. Everything's olive green and everything's dirty. There really isn't a lot of room for directorial flourish. But I like that director Hai Averback, where he puts the camera while he's shooting Father Mulcahy, he does a very, very up angle. And it's very reminiscent of what it was like to sit in a pew and look at someone if you were way up close. It's a nice little touch in a show that probably didn't allow for touches like that.
That's interesting that you say that, because at the beginning in the opening scenes with Frank Burns talking about how they drink too much, there's a shot that's very similar where it's from the ground up of Frank. And I remember thinking when I saw that, I really liked the way that looked, because it was him above and the top of the tent was over him, which you never really see,
right?
The top of the tent. And I remember thinking, that's a really interesting camera shot.
Yeah.
I guess he was laying his signature around that episode, maybe.
Yeah, I guess maybe had a little bit of extra time and thought, oh, I can put a little extra little visual life to this, which I always appreciate. By the way, you mentioned seeing the top of the tent. There is a brief little error in the previous scene in Mulcahy with the mess tent where he is getting the light shining down on him. If you look in the upper left corner, you actually see the back of the set.
Really?
Yeah. You can see this corner. There's this corner up in the upper left, and you will see the actual production set. They didn't bother to cut that. Well, not bother. They didn't notice. And so you can literally see, like, the production wall back there. So,
oh, that's so cool.
Doesn't happen much, but you do get to see it there.
Well, that's clearly Averback giving us a meta moment.
There you go.
I can't believe you didn't get that.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I got to do – maybe when I do another 200 episodes, I'll get better.
Yeah.
Now, I am curious as to your take on the way this episode ends, because it ends with Frank getting accidentally punched in, let's say the lower stomach. And he reacts by grabbing the Margaret's bottle and he's drinking it like he's a baby and he's, you know, and it's weird because this episode has taken the problem of drinking, I'd say, relatively seriously with the scene with Hawkeye and Trapper. But yet the whole issue seems to be resolved by them being able to drink again. Like it seems like a weird solution to the problem of everybody's drinking too much.
I kind of felt like maybe they got that they were drinking too much and I don't know. I feel like – I don't know why I feel that. And that may be that they weren't just going to drink as much. But it is interesting because I guess the way I read it, the way you're describing it, I think when I was watching it, I wasn't thinking so much about it. But the way you're sort of describing it, it's that I think everybody needs it at some point. And I think Burns hit this sort of high-pressure point and he also got injured. And so alcohol does – I don't want to say alcohol serves a purpose. There's lots of people who don't drink and shouldn't. But I'm saying that in situations like this, sometimes you need a drink. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so there was that realization that maybe we're just all trying to survive being stuck here together. And this is the way we cope, you know? And I think maybe that was the message, but you're right. I don't really know by that ending.
Yeah. It's a little like, I mean, obviously, if it gets out of control, and they actually did do episodes later on in the series about people who drink too much. There's an episode where Hawkeye tries to go cold turkey. There's another episode where a guest star, a friend of Margaret's, is an alcoholic. So they addressed it later on. But yeah, it is more like, okay, everyone needs a little something to get past this. And Frank is really, you know, overdoing it by just banning it entirely. So you can't take it too terribly seriously. And then it ends, the button on the whole episode is back in surgery, where there's a gag that Hawkeye and Trapper are sneaking liquor in, even on like a patient's body. As they talk about a nurse, two straws, and that ends the end. It's just a final tweak of Frank, of just like, yeah, all right, we're not listening to you. And presumably, you know, everything's back to normal, basically, the way it should be.
I was thinking about when you inject your watermelon with vodka.
Yeah, right.
Is that possible to do with a patient? I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. We could, yeah, those guys were pretty enterprising. So, but overall, I really like this episode. I think it's very, very funny. The one other thing I wanted to mention is in the opening scene, we talk about that they're watching a movie. They're watching They're watching this Alice Faye musical. And I can't help but wonder, I mentioned MST3K earlier. There are numerous scenes across MASH, the series, of the characters talking back to the screen. And while MASH certainly did not invent that, it does feel in some ways like a proto-MST3K, that you've got Hawkeye or BJ or whoever making fun of the movie as they're watching it. It feels a little bit that to me, like all you need is like their little silhouettes in the bottom corner saying funny things in front of the screen.
That's actually really interesting. I would be curious to know if that did have some sort of spark an idea or whatever, Joel Hodgson or whoever the person was that invented MST3K.
Yeah.
I love when they talk back to the movies. I love everything about the dynamics with the two leads, you know, whether it be BJ or Trapper. They did a really good job replacing Trapper. You know, I'm sure they were worried about that. But, like, there's something about the way those two guys just work together with their line deliveries that they make every moment great. And so when I think back to all those scenes where they were watching films and stuff, it was always really, it was never annoying. Like when you go to the movies, it's always annoying when somebody does that. But somehow they've managed to do it and it's really pleasant. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's just, they're always fun together.
You always figure that the movie that they're getting is old and it's, you know, so you don't mind the extra entertainment.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's you're not seeing something current. You're seeing something that's from actually the movie they're showing is from like 1940, I believe. So it's literally like a 10-year-old movie at that point. So,
yeah.
Overall, I really like Alcoholics Unanimous. I think it's a very, very funny show. It's got some nice messages in it. Is there a particular favorite line or favorite joke that you have from this episode?
Yeah, I think my favorite line, the one that made me laugh the hardest, was when Klinger was trying to talk about his Section 8, and I'm probably going to miss the line, the exact reading of it, but where he says, I'm going to have to re-enlist just to show that I'm crazy. And I think, yeah, you might. That would prove it.
That's true enough. My favorite line is when Hawkeye and Trapper are trying to break into the storage cabinet, and they've got these pile of keys, and Hawkeye is fumbling with it, and he points to one. And Trapper, and he's like, is this it? And Trapper says, that's for my wife's car.
Oh, that's right.
And then Hawkeye then grabs another key and he goes, what's that for? Her chastity belt? And Trapper mutters something that you can't quite hear, but he's clearly annoyed. And then Hawkeye retorts with, well, you won't let her drive, which I think is such a great.
It's so funny he took her key and he's like, well, she's a really bad driver. And I'm like, wow, you took it all the way to Korea. She must suck.
It's another bit where it sounds like an ad lib. I'm sure it isn't, but I just love the way, well, you won't let her drive. You know, it just seems like it's again, the great rapport these two guys had. So yeah, that's Alcoholics Unanimous. Amanda, thank you so much once again for stopping by. You know, I always love talking to you and I'm always happy to have you here on the show.
Thank you so much. I always love doing it. I always forget how much I love MASH. And then you're like, we're going to watch this episode. And then I start watching and listening to your show and going back to the old episodes and listening and watching along. And it's so much fun.
Well, thank you. Well, tell people where they can find you on the internet.
I guess the best place to look for me would be on Twitter. And my handle there is at Made for TV Mayhem. Or on Facebook, you can look for me at Made for TV Mayhem or at the Made for TV Mayhem show. And I have an Instagram page, which is also at Made for TV Mayhem.
All right. Very cool. Of course, if you want to follow this show, go to our website, fireandwaterpodcast.com. You can also subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. We're always talking MASH over on Twitter, which is at MASH477Cast. And if you want to support the Fire and Water Podcast Network, go to patreon.com/FW Podcast. And there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks to Adam Sanders, Nicholas Prom, Russell Burbage, Suzanne Holland, and new pledger Stan Peel for their support of MASHcast. I really appreciate it, everybody. That is just awesome. Thank you so much. So that's going to do it for this episode. So until next week, that is all.
Anyone. Anyone caught with any kind of intoxicating beverage will be severely disciplined. Well, we'll drink to that.
Who was that?